It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Wilcock.
Now, the next election, we think highly likely, is going to be fought on the economy, certainly on the cost of living crisis. It comes top of all of the polling, really, with most voters. And the unemployment figure came out today. I would say bad for people, but perhaps good if you are hoping for an interest rate cut from the Bank of England, because basically the jobless rate went up to 4.2% in the 3 months through to the end of February. So there you have, you know, a little bit of the pressure ratcheting up on employers and therefore fewer people in the economy working.
It's funny you mentioned the Bank of England, Caroline, because obviously you listen to Rishi Sunak and some of his advisers. They see the economy as the election to fight the election on. But some of their own party disagree, and some of them also have a lot of things to say about the Bank of England. A certain former Prime Minister has been, let's say, less than complimentary of Andrew Bailey and his fellow policymakers.
But it's not, what they're saying is not borne out by the facts. It's a smear. It's a smear.
Why is nobody countering that smear? I mean, you are, obviously, by writing the book.
I'm countering it. A lot of economists have countered it. A lot of... when I meet people, you know, quite often out canvassing or out on, you know, the street, people will say you did the right thing. So I think a lot of the public understand what I was trying to do. But the left have, in the same way as they sort of say, you know, government was trying to abolish the forests or they're trying to do this, they're trying to smear me with economic results that are clearly not, I'm clearly not responsible for. Whatever mistakes I may have made, and I'm not saying I haven't made mistakes, I did not cause Britain's lack of economic growth.
That was Liz Truss there, who went on Media Rounds yesterday promoting her new book, 10 Years to Save the West. I don't know if you listened to any of them, Caroline.
I have read a great deal about it, and being a lettuce comes up again and again.
It does. I mean, honestly, if you were a Conservative advisor, you would be reading some of these headlines through your fingers. Let me just go through. Like, abolishing the Supreme Court to get rid
in
of
Britain,
that.
Right.
In Britain. Tried to block Brexit. Terrible idea. Sack Andrew Bailey. I mean, kind of goes without saying if you'd heard that clip. She endorsed Donald Trump to win the US presidential race, saying the world is safer under him, which is quite a move from a former UK Prime Minister heading into election. She wants Nigel Farage to join the Tories, which again, if you're a Conservative pollster, again, head in hands. And then the smoking ban, debated in Parliament today, which is one of the few pieces of legislation the Conservatives actually want to do before the election, she says is being pushed by unelected civil servant bureaucrats, as opposed to Rishi Sunak, who announced it.
Yeah, which is strange. I mean, look, I get that idea. I mean, Boris Johnson was also highly critical of the phased sort of smoking ban.
He called it un-Churchillian.
Yes. You know, the party of Churchill's famously cigar smoking. Look, I just wonder what all of this is about. I mean, I was speaking to one very senior Conservative today, and we'll hear a bit more on that subject a bit later. But the question is, how can you have a former Prime Minister going to the United States, making these bold, bold claims. It is just such fissures out in the open for the Conservatives. How do they deal with this?
Well, I mean, some of our listeners would probably be shouting at us at this point to say we have to point out that Liz Truss is one of, if not the most unpopular politician in the UK currently. And so to give her views weight is to kind of do her a disservice. But then I think this like big media tour cements three things. Number one, the media still care about her because she is, like you say, a former prime minister with the weight of that office. Two, that she clearly has decided, for either cynical or genuine reasons, that it was the establishment and institutions that brought her down, and they are the subject of her ire, and that is her target audience. It was fascinating. I listened to the interview that she did to The Spectator, of the many broadcasts that she did, and Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator, goes to her, you know, we left the EU, and politicians like yourself used to blame the EU for migration. Now there was no excuse. And she goes, no, it's Whitehall. And she went straight to the next bogeyman. And then the third one, though, is Keir Starmer must be absolutely delighted, because what this signals is both this, for him, ties which is like into Truss's legacy, and also it declares open season for any senior Conservative with a grievance that the former Prime Minister is having a go. You can air yours too.
Well, in terms of Liz Truss's recent ruminations, I put some of this actually to the UK Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury, Gareth Davies, just this morning on Bloomberg Radio, alongside my colleague Tom McKenzie. We quizzed him about Liz Truss, but I began just by asking him, you know, firstly on the strength of the UK economy. It's the IMF taking place in Washington today. The Chancellor Jeremy Hunt is there. And of course, the IMF has been one of the more sceptical, more negative forecasters in terms of the UK economy, saying that the UK is going to have the highest inflation, slowest growth of any G7 economy in 2024. So firstly, on that point around the softness of the UK economy, here's Gareth Davies.
Take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. Look at them, obviously, and consider the potential impact of what they say. But what we are focused on in government is making sure we're putting in place the measures that will continue to get inflation down, grow our economy, reduce our debt, and enhance our productivity around the country. And that's what we're focused on every day.
Gareth, you're being very respectful and diplomatic around these institutions. Less so from the former Prime Minister Liz Truss, out with her book, of course, making comments, wanting to see Andrew Bailey, the BOE, sacked, wanting to see an end and scrapping to the OBR, endorsing President Trump. When it comes to the OBR, when it comes to the Bank of England, those common comments, how unhelpful are they? Or is that where the gravity of the Conservative Party is now heading?
I think it's up to any colleague to offer their views when they're asked.
Colleague. This is the former UK Prime Minister in an election year.
But nobody in government is saying that, I can certainly assure you. And we have absolute confidence in our independent Bank of England, the Governor. I think they're doing a great job under very difficult circumstances. And as I say, in the Treasury, we work very closely with them to make sure that we bear down on inflation. And that's what we've seen, from 11% to 3.4% on track, going towards 2%. Look at the results. And I think you can see that we work pretty well together.
That was Gareth Davies then, trying to distance himself then from the comments that Liz Truss had to make, or made. You know, he was talking about the Treasury and its work.
Well, for more on those UK jobs figures and the wider UK economy, let's be joined by our economics reporter, Irina Angell. Irina, put some perspective for us. How serious should we be taking this jump in unemployment?
Well, unemployment rose to 4.2% in the 3 months to February, and the previous reading was 4%. And now it's at the highest level since the summer of 2023. And we've also seen a drop in the total number of people on payrolls, and that's been the biggest drop since November 2020. So this is a sign that the labor market is loosening. However, we have problems with the labor force survey, and we've been having that for a while. The ONS has for months urged caution in interpreting these figures, because there's been a drop in the number of responses it receives for these surveys.
Okay, so there's a bit of skepticism around the data, and they are trying to fix that at the statistics office. They're trying to get more businesses basically to write back to them and give them an insight into the jobs market, which is how they figure out the unemployment figure. I mean, the issue with the unemployment data is, on the one hand, it's not good if you're an individual and you're seeing, you know, the number of new vacancies kind of going down, or you might have lost your job, or there's still a lot of people who are not working for health reasons, for example. But on the flip side, actually the loosening of the labour market, cooling the UK economy, is sort of what we need to see in order for the Bank of England to cut interest rates.
That's right. But this morning's job report was a bit of a mixed bag, because we've seen pay growth still stubbornly high at 6%.
Right.
It has eased a bit from 6.1%, but still, and you know, just to stress, this is a measure that the Bank of England watches carefully. It is still 6%, and that's, I think, still too high for the bank to be comfortable. Of course, rate cuts are still, most economists would agree that rate cuts are still on track for summer, but the exact timing is still a very heated debate.
I mean, you say rate cuts are still on track for summer. Over in the US, we're seeing this issue where the Fed are rapidly seem to be changing the way their rate path looks in response to sticky inflation. We get inflation numbers out tomorrow. How much could the BOE shift if things don't look as they're forecast?
Inflation is supposed to loosen tomorrow. We'll see the exact figures. And, you know, even today's labor market figures, they are in line with what the BOE is expecting for the full first quarter. So this is nothing that necessarily moves the needle in a significant way for the Bank of England.
Okay. Just looking into the data around employment, I mean, I mentioned, you know, the information around vacancies. There are fewer vacancies now, specifically, especially for younger workers. But there's also been a bit of an uptick in redundancies, hasn't there? That's one of the kind of red flags about whether there's going to be this sort of whiplash effect, because interest rates are above 5%. It takes time for that to feed through to the economy. Is there a worry that then you're going to see suddenly a big shift in terms of employment, which has been very, very good in Britain for a long time?
I know, and this is why today's increase is in unemployment is a sign of worry. And, you know, the UK dipped into a very shallow recession at the end of last year, and now it seems like we're out of the woods, but still growth is extremely slow. And for a business, you know, a growth rate that's below 1%, it's just stagnation.
The other thing that we see about sort of the UK labour force is, since COVID, there has been this big inactivity problem, and it has been different between different generations. What do the latest stats show about how that problem is bearing out in terms of, say, people between, like, 16 to 34 years or 35 to 49 years? Like,
the inactivity rate rose in the latest period, so in the 3 months to February, and the rise was mainly driven by those aged 16 to 34 years, also by young people. And interestingly, we're seeing more people in the 35 to 49 years old bracket returning to the labour market. So it seems that it's really young people driving up this trend.
Well, now to another topic that the government wants to tackle. It is planning to criminalise the creation of sexually explicit deep fake images, including when there's no intent to share those images. The Ministry of Justice says that people convicted of creating deep fakes without consent will face prosecution and an unlimited fine potentially, and that sharing those sorts of images could also result in jail. Joining us now to discuss this is the Women and Equality Select Committee Chair, Caroline Noakes, the MP. Welcome to Bloomberg Radio, Caroline. Thank you for joining us on this discussion. Look, firstly, how much of a difference do you think this sort of legislation is really going to make to explicit, deep fake, AI-driven images that we know are surging across the internet?
There's been a massive proliferation in them. If you look at the numbers that were created in 22 and then the numbers in 2023, they went up by a magnitude of way in excess of tenfold. So we know that people are making these images, and we also know about the level of distress that they cause to the victims of them. And I will describe them as victims. But this, I think, is evidence that we have to do more to protect women. We know that the majority of deepfakes created are of women, and we have to make sure that we have adequate curbs on what's going on online. And to be quite frank, at the moment, we just don't. And the efficacy of this proposed legislation. I guess the proof will be in the pudding, but we're beginning to see prosecutions around the sharing of deepfakes. And so I think this is a logical step forward.
Legislators worldwide, Caroline, have learned the lessons from social media and how quickly it changed and how long it took laws to catch up. How likely do you think politicians in the UK are going to be able to get a handle on how the internet is changing with AI?
It's a really good question and a really difficult one for legislators to grapple with. I can remember when we were first discussing the online safety legislation, before that was even debated in the Commons, we would hear, you know, really ambitious statements from ministers about we've got to future-proof this. Now, the stark reality is that anybody who operates online will know that future-proofing something is impossible, and that you only have to witness what goes on in social media, how quickly the platforms change, evolve, new ones come on stream, to know that attempts at future-proofing are absolutely, I'm going to say, futile. But if we don't try, then we leave young people particularly exposed to the Wild West. And are any of us happy with that? Are we happy with the proliferation of violent and degrading pornography that we see online, that we know is being accessed by really young children? That most children will have seen violent porn online by the time they're 13 years old. So we have to try, but I'm the first to acknowledge that this feels like a battle that we're almost set up to fail.
Yeah, look, that's such a depressing statistic, isn't it? You know, in terms of exposure for young children. Look, the issue, though, is about announcing a measure like this and about how seriously we should really take this sort of legislative effort. We know that the biggest names in technology are abetting the surge in deepfake pornography, which is really only in its infancy. Bloomberg's reported that Google, for instance, is the main traffic driver. Users of X, formerly Twitter, regularly circulate deepfake content. Amazon, Cloudflare, Microsoft, GitHub, they all provide the sort of hosting services for the websites where the deepfake images can appear if they are indeed shared. So there's lots of knowledge about, you know, something that is could potentially be happening on an industrial scale. And it feels like Britain's trying to go house to house policing this, which just seems mad.
Oh, and look, I have coming in front of my select committee at the beginning of next month, a range of experts on this, but notably we invited Meta and they're refusing to come. And that's the stark reality. At the moment, we have many of the platforms just refusing to engage. And what we do know as well is that they have the AI that could stop this dead, is that the publication, if that's the right term, of deepfake images can be spotted by machine learning, but nobody seems to be prepared to deploy those tools. And really, I think there has to be almost a plea from government to the platforms, help here, help children. And that's the stark message. It's young people and it's predominantly women. And for too long, we've seen the platforms like Google, like Microsoft, prepared to shrug their shoulders and pretend it's not their problem. This is everybody's problem. And we want to make sure that there are protections in place for victims of this. And I've spoken to people who've been victims of deepfake pornography, and the distress is immense. And the stark reality is that if you're the Taylor Swifts of this world, you get it taken down because you're a big name and the platforms want to help you. They don't want to help, you know, Mrs. Smith from Wigan, do they? They're not interested in that. And this therefore becomes a legislative challenge for government, for all of us to look at and say, what can we do? And if we don't try, are we just shrugging our shoulders and leaving it to the next generation? Well, I don't think we should do that.
I mean, it's interesting you bring up that case, because Meta just today are saying that they are investigating how the company handled those AI-generated deepfakes of Taylor Swift and whether they should have been taken down under Meta's content policies. I've had this debate in journalism for a couple of decades now, Caroline, of who is responsible for things posted online. Yet social media platforms argue they're conduits versus publishers. there's this added dimension now in that you have the platforms, you have then the creators of the AI tools, you have the individuals who are using those tools to make this stuff, and then you have the consumers. You've mentioned the platforms a bit there, but of those kind of groups, who do you think should be bearing the responsibility for these images and their proliferation?
So I don't think it's the consumers, because I think that algorithms are driving content to consumers that they are unaware of how that's happening. And we know it, don't we? That if I go on Facebook now, I will be shoved endless images of icing of cakes because I watched a video once. Yeah, that's very benign, but we know that the technology just drives you more and more of the same content. I think it is the platforms. They don't want to accept responsibility, but I don't think they should have any choice about that. And I think it requires collective global effort. And actually, when it comes to things like Twitter, and I genuinely regard X, formerly known as Twitter, as perhaps the worst, the Wild West of these sorts of platforms, is, you know, eventually I live in some sort of new land of hope where we'll all just turn our backs on it. I know that I use it a great deal less than I would have done probably just 2 or 3 years ago. And the stark reality is that we need to find initiatives that are going to get us back living in the real space and away from online social media content that is, to be quite frank, addling young people's brains.
Well, Bloomberg's been reporting that the government's also in talks with social media platforms to try to get them to sign up to the UK's voluntary charter, trying to give parents more control over their teen social media use. I mean, there is, I would say, and characterise it as a backlash occurring now. I mean, there are some quite significant kind of groups emerging of parents who really want social media to be restricted for younger people, people under the age of 16 in particular. Is that a good idea?
Well, I think the genie's out of the bottle. I think it's a really difficult battle to have. I think it's incumbent upon all of us as parents and indeed educators to make sure that we're having decent conversations with young people, that we're using subjects like PSHE in school, so relationship, sex, health education, to make sure that young people are properly equipped to know what they're seeing, to be sufficiently analytical to know that what they're seeing might not be real, to understand the harms that can be caused. And
so you don't agree with an under 16s ban on social media, for example?
Well, look, I think the whole while we as parents are handing over smartphones to our children, and we're going to carry on doing that because guess what? We like to have apps where we can keep tabs on where your young people are. We want them to be able to stay in contact with us. Mm. I think it's really unrealistic to think that you can plonk a social media ban on the under 16s. But I think we have to make sure that they are properly tooled up to know what the dangers are out there. And to know that really, really unscrupulous people will use all sorts of apps in order to target and groom young people. And we have to be prepared to have really difficult conversations with our children about that.
I mean, you've pointed direct to the platforms here, but it's worth saying, I think you look at the research that's being done on the influence Andrew Tate is having in schools. The FT does some fascinating research, John Byrne-Murdoch, on the sort of increasing political split between men and women. At the end of the day, AI and social media are tools. Is the problem here with tools or with men?
Oh, and those tools are predominantly owned and driven by men, isn't it? We know that the vast majority of people who are writing those algorithms are young men. We also know, if you look at some of the surveys done by organisations like Internet Matters, that Andrew Tate has a really pernicious influence on not even particularly young men. So actually teenagers are more discerning about the evils of Andrew Tate than their dads are. I think Internet Matters did a survey that said 56% of young dads thought that there was much positive in Andrew Tate. This is a man who has been charged with sex trafficking. Let's not forget that ever. And so, look, I think there is a problem with toxic masculinity. I think there is a problem with us not providing young men with enough positive role models. I think my select committee has called for relationship and sex education to have specific elements that are targeted at young men, enabling them to have much more constructive conversations around relationships, around consent, around respect for their peers. And we have to be prepared to have those difficult subjects in our schools. We can't shy away from them and pretend that we don't need to discuss these things, because otherwise you end up in a situation where, according to one of the surveys I read, young men thought that their girlfriends wanted to be choked by them during sex, and young women thought that their boyfriends expected to choke them. Neither of them wanted the activity to take place, but they thought it was an expectation of them. And so, you know, what sort of world is it that we're just not equipping young people with the ability to understand the importance of consent, the importance of respect for each other, and impressing upon them the need to be really careful with the content that you see online, much of which will now not be real at all?
Does this legislation come to pass? Does it actually get enacted? Or do you think the Labour Party, they have been supportive. Yvette Cooper, the Shadow Home Secretary, has welcomed, you know, the idea of, you know, criminalising these deep fake images. But do you think there's going to be any progress? Are we in a lame duck period?
So look, this is a government amendment to the Criminal Justice Bill. So I would have every confidence that they can get that through. I think it's worth reflecting. Over the past four and a half years or so, we've seen things like the rough sex defence included as part of the Domestic Abuse Act. And that was a cross-party initiative from Harriet Harman, who many of us regard as the mother of the House. And at the time, Laura Farris, the very newly elected Member of Parliament for Newbury, and now the Victims Minister, and a minister that sits in both the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice. I have every confidence that Laura is somebody who is going to drive this through and make sure that it happens. And, you know, what I want to see as chair of the Women and Equalities Committee is legislation that is put in place specifically to protect women. And I think this is a step forward.
Caroline Noakes, chair of the Women and Equalities Select Committee. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm really great to speak to you. Yeah, lovely to speak to you, Caroline. Thank you so much for your time. Look, I think this is a very interesting issue. Of course, you've got to remember that the government declared violence against women as a national threat in 2023. And this was meant to, force this as an issue for the police to prioritise in terms of tackling this issue. But it's sort of one of many, and I'm afraid I have to raise quite a sceptical eye given the conviction rates for physical crimes against women is so poor in the UK. You've got to wonder whether tackling stuff that happens online is going to be any easier.
I mean, I weirdly think this will be an electoral issue in that you have the Sarah Alvaro case, and then but also both parties see crime as an issue they think they can win over the public and women especially.
Yeah.
Earlier, I spoke to Patsy Stevenson. She's a campaigner perhaps best known for being arrested by the Met during the Sarah Everard vigil and then receiving an apology and damages. I started by asking her to explain to me what being a woman on the internet is like and how AI is changing it. Patsy, as a man, could you help me understand what being a woman on the internet is like and how AI is changing that?
Of course. So, I mean, the internet... I'm 31, so I grew up in a time where I saw the rise of the internet come into our everyday lives. And I think that it does mimic and sometimes enable a lot of things we see in society, like sexism, racism, homophobia. So on the internet as well, you can be anonymous. It's easier sometimes to be misogynistic, for example. So being a woman on the internet, you have to always watch what you're saying, who you're talking to, and there's a lot of different things that I've experienced, which I'm sure many other women have as well, where pictures are being leaked or threatened to be leaked, and stuff like that is a very scary thing to go through.
How prevalent is this kind of new danger of deepfake porn? And like, how much has it gained in visibility to you over the past few months? Because Taylor Swift's obviously the big sort of celebrity that changed everything.
I mean, I think before that it was very common. So I think it's only really come into prominence now in the media because of Taylor Swift and what happened to her. But this has been going on for quite a while. I mean, we saw deepfakes come into the internet a long, long time ago, years ago. But things always start off almost on the dark web and then come to popularity in common places on the internet. So now we're seeing more and more of this, especially because the tools that we use to make deepfakes or AI creations are so commonplace. Now you can have, I know that Photoshop, there's things that allow you to use AI very quickly and very easily. But I think it's one of those things, the same as social media. When social media first came out, everyone gets scared of it, but it is a progression in society. So it's a good thing that we have it.
Okay, so there's a progression. This new technology's come out. The government have legislated to it. Job done? Everything's happy?
Definitely not. I mean, these things are never job done anyway, but I think there is a good side to it because we do sometimes need laws around these things. However, I think AI is very tricky because it is relatively new to the common public. I think that we have to be careful where we legislate and what we legislate about. For example, AI can be used in loads of beneficial ways, especially to everyone going through misogyny. So, for example, deepfakes can be used to imitate or create a fake child, for example, that some organisations are using to lure predators so they can catch them. And that way, there's not a real image of a child being used, for example, so no one's being hurt in that instance. There's lots of things that AI can be used for that is so beneficial. That it needs to be open to the public, though, so that everyone can use it for it to be able to develop and progress. Now, allowing government to make legislation around this, I don't think is the best way around it, because the government itself doesn't actually understand the tech or AI, and oftentimes they will be forced into a position of either learning it very quickly, in which they're going to misunderstand it or make assumptions about it. And a lot of the public are scared of it because they don't know much about it. So I think what we need, in my opinion, is maybe an organisation, and there are organisations out there that do this, but an organisation to work alongside the government that know about AI and tech, who know what they're talking about, that is their area of expertise, who can also work with legislation or regulation around it that isn't allowing our future progression of AI to be hindered by the government controlling it.
So why is it governments are so bad, or this legislation so bad, then, that you think the government can't be trusted to handle this? Because I mean, the alternative, like you say, is an outside organisation or tech companies themselves. But I'm getting the impression you don't think either should be really trusted.
No, see, that's the thing. So a lot of tech companies, again, I'm sorry, but a lot of people in tech are men. It's a very male-dominated field. And I did a TEDx talk on this. When you have a lot of people in the field who aren't in marginalized groups, they either aren't aware or they're ignorant to the issues that other people face. So when we've got, I think it's only 22% of all AI creators around the world are women, even less so from other marginalized groups. We get to a place where those organizations that I want to be beside the government helping probably aren't going to be very good either. So I think this is a conversation that needs to be had immediately. And we need to get people who are experts in the field, but aware of misogyny and racism, homophobia, for example, and who can implement those regulations without harming anyone.
I mean, you point to the government, the police, tech companies, all these people creating these tools. Is the problem here in your mind tools or men and the culture around it?
Yeah, the main problem, you know, we're looking at slight prevention and slight, you know, what regulations we can put in place now. But really, when you get down to the bottom issue, the issue is that in society, misogyny, racism, homophobia, these things are still very prevalent in everyday society. We saw it just recently with the Sydney attack, for example. I think that in society, we need to be educating people at a very young age to know what misogyny is, to know that it's not acceptable, and really start from scratch rather than wait until something's happened to then say, well, this is illegal, you shouldn't be doing this.
But misogyny, online health, how the internet works for women, it's something that you've dedicated a lot of your time to since the Sarah Everard vigil. And I've seen sort of online that something you say takes a lot of toll on you. Do you think it's something that the internet, that governments and tech companies are responding to, or is it going to get worse before it gets better?
I do believe it's going to get worse before it gets better. Unfortunately, for example, the Taylor Swift incident was the only time that people really stood up and took notice. So I don't think it should take those types of big incidences for it to happen to someone in the public eye very openly, for them to change and have those discussions. I personally think that being 31, I've seen that difference of feminism coming into play and people started to understand misogyny, started to work on sexism in society, then I truly believe that over COVID, a lot of young men were going online and looking at people like Andrew Tate and awful supposedly role models who are definitely shouldn't be role models at all. And I think right now we've just had a recent poll that says a lot of young men are actually anti-feminist, which is baffling to me because feminism is about equality for everyone. That's the whole point. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions about equality and feminism. I think we are going downwards in terms of women's rights. I hope that that will go back up at some point, but I think optimism is the only way to look at it at this point.
I guess just finally what I'm trying to get is, like, you're a 31-year-old woman who campaigns on this stuff and is very kind of aware of it, and I have in my mind what a teenager, sort of a young girl might have been exposed to. Can you speak to kind of what it is like to be kind of that age and on the internet at the moment?
Yeah, terrifying, I would say. I think you know, at the moment, I think there's a lot of social pressure as well, you know, filters as well. But I don't want to be one of those types of people that says that children shouldn't go online, because I was online from a young age and I saw things that I shouldn't have seen. But I think that if you are going to take away the internet and take away WhatsApp, take away social media from children, they will find it. They will go on it. They're much more tech savvy than we ever were. So I think that it's educating your children on the dangers rather than restricting. I think that's the only way, and having them open conversations with people, because I think young women at the moment, young girls, are probably going through very traumatic experiences online, but everyone has to be online. It's the next progression for our society, so education is key.
That was Patsy Stevenson, a campaigner who was arrested by the Met during the Sarah Everard vigil and is now looking to campaign on the issue of AI and how it affects women's lives.
Well, look, that's it from us for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo and Mia Dawkins, and our audio engineer was Sean Guastamacchia. I'm James Walcock.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.